Well then, I think we'll start to, and I'll start to introduce to you Jeff Cole, the father of World Internet Project. We're very proud to have you here today or tonight with us. So please come up and let us know more about your World Internet Project and everything else.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back here in Stockholm, even on this very stage again. Greetings from the United States, where we've been working overtime to bring down your economy. And I think we're starting to do a pretty good job. It's nice to know we still can do something well. And sorry about that. Anyway, I've been asked, and it's late in the day, and so let me try to be as upbeat and do this quickly. I know I've been told I should get you out of here by 8:30, so let's get started. Anyway, let me spend a minute or two sharing with you some of the work I do and a little bit about the World Internet Project, and then share some of the things we're finding around the world. And let me start with the fact, I'm an old TV guy. I spent most of my life in and around the world of television, and in the work I did in television, I was always taught that we blew it where television was concerned. We lost a great opportunity. And what I mean by that is television, if you think about it, is the only mass medium we knew ahead of time was going to be a mass medium. There was no question in the 1940s that radio listeners were going to embrace radio with pictures. So since we knew that television was going to be a phenomenon before the first signal was ever broadcast, what I was taught that we should have done but didn't do is we should have tracked people before they had television and then gone back to them year after year as they acquired and used television to see how it changed their lives. And if we had done that, we would have learned some pretty compelling things, starting with where did the time for television come from? When Swedes, Americans, other Europeans were watching 3 hours of television a day, and we were asked, where did those 3 hours come from? What were we doing less of? We didn't know. We just grabbed that time out of the air. We could have learned if those 3 hours came from talking as a family, reading books or newspapers, sleep, or from some other place. And I became convinced in the late 90s, working with broadcast networks, that the impact of digital technology, first the internet and now mobile, was going to dwarf that of television. Television's mostly about leisure and entertainment. The web has already transformed for practically every single one of you in this room on a minute-by-minute basis, how you communicate, how you work, how you play, and probably its most important long-term impact will be how we learn. So believing that we lost a great opportunity with television and that the impact of the web was going to be even greater than television, 8 years ago we launched this project, this look at the internet that we thought should have been conducted of television in the 1940s. And very briefly, you're not a bunch of college professors, I don't think, so I won't spend all my time on methodology. Although if anyone's interested in our methods, when we're finished, I'll tell you as much as you could ever want to know, and maybe even a little bit more. Except to say we started in the United States in the year 2000 with a representative sample of the American population. And we've gone back to the same people 8 years in a row. And we've watched as non-users went to dial-up, as dial-up users moved to broadband. We saw immediately broadband changed everything. Not for the reason most people got broadband, not because of the speed, but the always-on, the direct connection, changed our relationship to the internet, made it our most important source of information, made us want the internet not only everywhere in our homes, but in our cars, in our offices, and even in our pockets. We watch as about 2% drop off the web each year, and we want to know who are these people who leave and why. And more importantly, do they return? And if so, when and what brings them back? And then lastly, 8 years in, we continue to track the never users. Who are the people who have never gone online? Who are they? Why have they never gone online? How do they do things offline the rest of us do online? And increasingly a question we're starting to ask, should we care that they're not online? Should we be twisting their arms, persuading them, cajoling them? If you live in Mexico and you make 300,000 pesos a year, right now that translates into about 30,000 US dollars. That will change when the peso and dollar hit parity, which ought to be any day now. But if you make more than 30,000 US dollars, you have to file your taxes online. One of the ways the Mexican government's trying to increase its 21% internet penetration. Should you be doing that in Sweden to get the last 20% online, or should you let those people live their lives peaceably and happily off of the web? We started our work in the U.S. We're now in 30 countries all over the world. We're in all the places you would expect us to be, Canada, the U.K., Japan, Australia, New Zealand. We're in some pretty unusual places. We have a great partner in Iran. We know more about what's happening with media and the internet in Iran than the American government does, but no big surprise. We have partners in Bolivia, and we have a superb partner from year one here in Sweden with the World Internet Institute in Gävle. And as you know, they released their 2008 report this morning, which I believe is in all of your packets in Swedish. And it's a great report. They've been a superb partner from day one. We've even had one of our international meetings here in Stockholm or in Gävle in 2001. So that's a little bit of the work I do. Let me share with you some of the things we're finding all over the world. We've learned from being out there in the field for 7 years. And let's start first with the fact that the internet now doesn't appear to be a threat to television, which implies that at one point we thought it was, and we did. If you look at this is a chart from 2004, and I'll tell you why it's 2004 in a minute. And if you look, I just gave you a sample of about 8 countries. If you look around the world, you can see in every country we are in, internet users in the dark colors say they're watching less television. Here in Sweden, numbers are quite dramatic. 21% of Swedes say they're watching less television since going online, and less than half of 1% say they're watching more. Numbers are comparable, or even more people say they're watching less television in Spain and the U.S. Now, the broadcast networks all over the world don't like this, but this is not a big surprise, or wasn't a big surprise. Because if you look at the average Swede or the average anyone, almost all of our at-home awake time has been dominated by television. Most of us turn the television set on the moment we enter the home, leave it on till we go to sleep. Some of us go to sleep with it on. Some of us even leave it on when we're not at home so that people think we are at home. And if we're going to carve out time at home to do anything, take a walk, take a nap, take a shower, that time almost always comes from television. But then we learned in 2004, we only had part of the story. It wasn't the internet that was a threat to television. It was dial-up that was a threat to television. And let me explain. Back in the dial-up era, there's not much dial-up left in Sweden. You're one of the most advanced broadband societies on the face of the earth, but you're young enough or old enough to remember the early days of dial-up and the annoying whirls and clicks. If you think of your dial-up life, the average dial-up user we saw went online 2 to 3 times a day, 20 to 30 minutes at a time. We aggregated our tasks because we didn't want to go on that many times. We wanted to put on the back of an envelope all the things we wanted to do so that we did them all at once and made efficient use of our time. And even though the act of dialing up only took 30 seconds, we viewed it as a big deal. So we aggregated all of our time into these buckets of 20 or 30 minutes. And that was generally buckets of 20 or 30 minutes that was spent not talking to your family, although your family could wander around and talk to you while you were online. And it was generally 20 or 30 minutes spent not watching television, although many people multitasked from the beginning. We also saw that since people were going online for 20 or 30 minutes at a time, they tended, where they had a choice, to move the internet into the backstage of the home, if their home had a backstage. They would move the internet because they were on in these buckets of minutes into a back bedroom, an office, someplace where they could be undisturbed. With broadband, we saw the average broadband user was on 30 to 50 times a day, 2 to 3 minutes at a time. We didn't have to aggregate our tasks into buckets of minutes. We could simply do what we wanted to do in these little pockets of minutes because we could do 2 or 3 things online. And if we forgot something, we could come back 2 minutes later because we didn't have to dial up. It was right there. Because we were going online 30, 40, 50 times a day, we didn't want to go into the backstage or the back bedroom of the home. And that was what we saw beginning in 2003, 2004. People with broadband were moving the internet into the center stage of the home, into the family room, into the den, and especially into the most humanly networked room in the house, which most of you probably know is the kitchen. The kitchen, the first room in which almost everybody stops when they enter the home, the room in which most women leave their purses. If you're going to leave a message for somebody else in the family, you almost always do so in the kitchen. The kitchen also contains the family art gallery, also known as the refrigerator. So people were moving the internet to where they were. And all of a sudden, it wasn't displacing family conversation anymore. It was occurring during the natural rhythms of family conversations, when there was a minute or two pause. And it wasn't displacing television programming viewing anymore. We were now going online before the program started, after it ended, or even more worrisome for broadcast networks, during the commercial. It became one more thing we did during the commercial. But I'll show you in a couple of minutes how I think television is actually going to thrive digitally because of the internet and because of broadband. What I want to look at before I get there is a little bit on how traditional media are changing. I used to teach mass communication a long time ago. And when I used to teach, I argued that no medium ever disappears. It adapts. It changes. If ever a medium would have disappeared, it would have been radio after the beginning of television. When television sucked all the content out of radio, took all the stars out of radio, but radio didn't roll over and die. It learned how to form alliances with the music industry. In Sweden, you have an extraordinarily vibrant public radio system. Radio thrives, but as a smaller business before television. As we look at these traditional media around us in a digital era, we don't think any of them will disappear. But we think most of them, with one important exception, will be smaller businesses in a digital era. I'll give you some examples. If you take theatrical film, the going to the movies, in 1946, in the English-speaking world, 4.3 billion movie tickets were sold. Last year, in 2007, the population more than doubled. To keep pace, you would have had to sell 9 billion movie tickets. Instead, last year in the English-speaking world, we sold 1.4 billion. Put another way, 1946, 90 million people a week went to the movies. Last year, population more than doubled, 23 million people a week went to the movies. The movie business is a shell of what it used to be, the theatrical movie business, and yet it's a highly profitable business, a very glamorous business. It drives the home video business, but it's a tiny business compared to what it used to be. Now, it's no coincidence that 1946 was the peak. That was on the eve of the introduction of television, and television has forever changed. But the movie business has learned how to survive and thrive as a smaller business. The music business. The business model of the music business is nothing short of extortion. The business model of the music industry says you like 2 songs, you have to go out and spend $18 on a CD. Today, interest in music has never been greater. People are listening to more music in more places than they ever have before, creating their own playlist, mashups. Love of music has never been higher. But people are not going to the music store and spending the $18 on the two songs. I walked around Stockholm, and like every other city I walk around, you can barely find a music store anymore. There was one, and if you keep looking in another couple of years, you probably won't see that. People are not going to the music store and spending the money on the full CD. They're either going to illegal peer networks and stealing the music, or they're going to legal downloading services, the most famous example being iTunes, and buying the two songs. The depressing notion for the music industry is if they get it right, if they figure out how to get their customers to pay for music digitally, and they do, and they succeed, and everything works, and that's a big if, what used to produce $18 for them will now produce $2 for them. You can see that in sales figures for the $18 CD. Traditionally, a number one selling album in the 80s and 90s had to sell at least 15 million copies to be number one. Occasionally, you'd see an album that would sell 30 million copies. A Michael Jackson's Thriller, an Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill, Eagles' Greatest Hits, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. But you had to sell at least 15 million to be number one. 2005, the number one album in the world, at least the world where it's counted, we don't know what's happening with Chinese music, but number one album 2005, Mariah Carey's The Emancipation of Mimi, became number one with 4.9 million copies sold. 2006, Disney's High School Musical at 3.9 million copies. 2007, I never would have guessed this in my life. It was almost Disney's High School Musical 2, but got beaten at the end of the year by Josh Groban's Christmas album. You've never heard of Josh Groban? Neither have I. 3.7 million copies. And the number one selling album in 2008, if the year ended today, would be Coldplay. At 2.9 million copies. CD sales are already down 25%. And it's interesting that Coldplay promoted their album by releasing their first single for free on the internet. I actually believe within the next 6 years, all music will be free. Free of purchase price. There will be advertising and there may be other conditions. I don't think music's going to be sold much longer. Already, music companies are looking at other ways of making money. When they're signing with groups like Madonna, they're now taking a cut of their touring revenue. Digital doesn't hurt touring. It actually enhances it because it creates more interest in the music. They're taking a cut of revenues. The music business will survive. It will be popular, in many ways more popular than it's ever been, but it will be a smaller business. And the newspaper business, whether it's a major national or city newspaper like our New York Times, you're often blog it. Traditionally for a major paper, 75% of that paper has been advertising. There will never come a day that 75% of a newspaper website will ever be advertising. On the other hand, while newspapers will collect less advertising revenue, for most big newspapers, 70%, or let me put it the other way, only 30% of a big city newspaper's budget goes to editorial, goes to writers and editors. The other 70% goes to printing and distribution. And in a digital era, those costs almost go down to zero, and therefore you can afford to make less revenue. But I'll come back to newspapers in a minute. So most media, we think, are smaller businesses in a digital era. The exception is television. We think television is about to explode with growth, be bigger than it's ever been, escape from the home, and be our constant companion. Our work shows fairly definitively that people will watch television on small screens in their pockets. Not just 2 or 3 minute clip packages, but 30 and 60 minute shows. Sometimes straight through if they're stuck at the airport waiting for a plane. Sometimes in 5 or 10 parts. Keep in mind that at the same time as we're putting mobile screens in our pockets, we're buying bigger and better screens at home than we've ever had before. The gap between the home and the theater has never been so narrow. The time gap has never been so short. I gave a talk a couple of months ago, and there was a guy in the audience who says, I'm a Canadian and I'm a big hockey fan. although that's sort of redundant to be Canadian and a hockey fan. And he said, why would I ever watch a hockey game on a small screen in my pocket? And the answer is, you won't. If you love hockey, you're going to seek out the biggest and best screen you can find, unless it's more important to see it sooner rather than later and you can't get to the big screen. We're going to save our favorite content, compelling content, for the big screen. Nobody's going to watch Lord of the Rings for the first time on a mobile phone. Finally, the opening ceremony of the Olympics justified my purchase of my high-definition television set. That stuff belongs there, but we think we're going to shift lots of our other content to mobile phones. And as we do, we see television escaping from the home. Until now, television never really existed outside the home. The exception's the hospital. If you're sick, that's your home. The bar, for some people, that's their home. But we think people are going to take television now to the airport while they're waiting, on the airplane itself, in the back seat of a car, hopefully not the front seat while we're driving. And as we do, it's going to be our companion. If we're stuck at the airport now and bored, what do most of us do? We pull out our mobile phones and call somebody, and it's only after they answer do we figure out whether we really have anything to say to them. My mother figured this out a long time ago. Whenever I call my mother, she says, what, you're stuck somewhere? You have nothing better to do than to call me? And she's right. She also figured out it means we get to talk more often. Television is going to be around us all the time. I want to make the point that as I'm talking about these things now, terms like television, newspaper, magazines only refer to what these media used to be off of the web. On the web, these terms become irrelevant. And let me just say, Sweden's the biggest newspaper reading society on the face of the earth. Let me just talk about newspapers for a moment. Everybody knows digital is the biggest threat newspapers have ever faced. We know that 30 years ago, teenagers didn't read newspapers, but started to when they got into their 20s and 30s. In almost every country in the world we are in, Sweden continues to be a bit of an exception, not a total exception. In almost every country we're in, when internet penetration gets to 30%, offline newspaper sales begin to stall a little bit or decline. The bottom line for newspapers, and it's not very exciting, is that every time a newspaper reader dies, he or she is not being replaced with a new reader. How much time do they have? We think it's 20, 25 years, but that may be accelerated by the second biggest threat newspapers have ever faced. And while everybody's talking about the biggest threat, I'm one of the few people talking about the second biggest threat, and that's global warming. Now that everybody on the face of the earth, except my president, believes that global warming is real, 89 days, I think we're going to start turning to each other, looking at each other and saying, who are the villains? Who are the culprits? Who are the bad guys? I'll give you one example. There's a story in the front page of my local newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, about 3 months ago. And it was about our governor in California. Now, normally you wouldn't know who the governor of California is, but in this instance, you do know who the governor of California is. And incidentally, my governor can beat up your governor, or at least he used to be able to. The story about Governor Schwarzenegger, I can just about say that now without laughing. The story about, although it's actually a pretty good governor. Story about Governor Schwarzenegger and the fact that he commutes every day from Los Angeles to Sacramento, a distance of about 600 kilometers. And he does so by private jet. And if this story had appeared 10 years ago, the angle of the story would have been, how can a government official use state funds to travel by private jet? But that wasn't the angle. He doesn't travel using state funds. His salary for making Terminator 3 was a Gulfstream 4 jet. He was actually paid with a Gulfstream 4 worth about $30 million. He's a very wealthy man. He operates it himself. The angle of the story is not using state money. The angle of the story was, according to the expert they cited, and you can always get an expert to say anything, a Gulfstream in an hour uses more carbon than an automobile in a year. And now there's pressure on Schwarzenegger not to commute. I think we're going to start doing this, looking around, blaming people. And when we do, fairly or unfairly, one of the industries that's going to be at the top of the list is going to be newspapers. Because here I'll use an American example because of size. If you look at our New York Times, it prints 200 million pieces of paper a day, except on Sunday when it prints 2 billion pieces of paper. And then hires thousands of trucks using gasoline spewing carbon into the air to deliver those papers. And teenagers are now turning to their parents saying, how can you read the newspaper? Don't you care about the earth? Many of you have probably noticed you're starting to get emails that now say at the bottom, please be kind to the earth, don't print this out. We think, now a lot of that's unfair, because people perceive newspapers as wasteful, even though they may be printed on recyclable paper, and we perceive digital as completely green. And that's not fair at all. Digital's not green at all, but to the user, it appears to be green. The last theme I really want to look at, actually I talked about that already, is I want to talk about how all this content is going to be paid for. How we're going to support all this content on the web and on mobile phones. And our work showed from 2000 to 2005, nobody wanted to pay for digital content. People thought that all the content on the web ought to be free the way the good Lord intended it to be. And then in 2005, two things began to happen. First, some of the enthusiasm for free or illegal downloading began to wane. People began to associate the illegal downloading sites not just with free and cool content, but also with spyware and viruses. At the same time, we saw, in the same year, we saw the introduction of the first easy-to-use, reasonably priced legal downloading services, the most famous example being iTunes. Until then, the music companies had buried their heads in the sand. Their customers had come to them beginning in the mid-90s saying, we don't want to spend $18 for the two songs we want. We want to buy the two songs. And we want to download them on our computers, and we want to then move them to our MP3 players and burn a copy on a CD and play them in our cars. And the music industry, which really liked its extortion model, which said you had to spend the $18 for the two songs, said, we're not going to let you buy the two songs. And if you want to play them in three locations, you have to buy three CDs. And the customer said, no way, and started stealing the music. Music companies made really bad decisions. Sony, a company I work with, Sony, a company I love. Sony, the company that should have invented the iPod. Sony, the company you expected to invent the iPod. And why didn't Sony invent an iPod or a high-quality MP3 player? Because they had a music division that wouldn't let them introduce a high-quality MP3 player. And what did that decision get them? It got them screwed twice. It got them screwed on the one hand because they didn't introduce the hardware device that would have made them billions of dollars and the coolest company on the planet, which I think we can agree Apple, most people think, is. And it got them screwed on the other hand because the decision not to introduce a high-quality MP3 player did nothing to protect their music. Their music still got stolen. It may as well have been stolen by a Sony device. Lots of bad decisions were made. But beginning in 2005, we saw some willingness to pay for digital content. That willingness disappeared pretty quickly because we found people didn't really want to pay over the long term. I did a talk earlier this year in Cannes at the Lions Awards, and I got around to doing some research I'd always wanted to do. I did it in the United States. Some of our partners have done it in other countries. And always wanted to know the answer to the question. I'll say this for America, but I don't think the numbers are much different in Sweden. I wanted to know how much money does the average American household spend on communication services that didn't exist a generation ago. So we're not talking about landline phones, which our parents and grandparents had, but we're talking about mobile phones. We're talking about cable or satellite television, broadband, PVR, satellite radio, all of these charges. And what we found in America is the average household spending $260 a month. on things that didn't exist a generation ago. What's shocking to us is if you look at the poorest households in America, now this would not be true in Sweden. You have fewer class divisions than just about any society on the face of the earth, and the difference between your rich and poor, as you know, is extraordinarily narrow, and you just have to see what's been happening on Wall Street to know how wide our gap between rich and poor is. But if you look at the poorest Americans, they still spend $180 a month. The poorest people, and that's true here as well, to the poorest people, mobile phones are not an option, not a luxury. They are a fact of life. Sadly, the poorest people sometimes pay more for mobile phones because they may not have credit and have to get prepaid. For the poorest Americans, where 91% of us get our television through cable or satellite and only 9% free to air, giving up television is not an option. They may not have broadband, but broadband's getting closer and closer to being a necessity as well. But the resolution of this is we found the people who are spending $260 or more a month are saying, I don't want to spend another $30, $40, $50 on digital fees and subscriptions. And what we're seeing is for the first time, people are saying now, I'm willing to make the same deal with the web and mobile that I made with television, which is advertising as the price of, quote, free content. There are only three ways to acquire content. Steal it. Even those who steal it acknowledge that's not a very viable business model. Pay fees or subscriptions or advertising. We think the average household at most will subscribe to two or three services and maybe not even that many. We think that will generally be around highly specialized financial information. We think if content on the web and on mobile is going to survive, that survival comes from advertising. And that's advertising with a whole new set of rules. You advertise on television and you run an ad that's not very good or offends somebody, the worst thing that happens is the ad's not effective. You run an ad on the internet that offends people, such as pop-up ads a few years ago, they will share them with each other, they will lobby you, boycott you, hunt you down, and kill you. Not literally kill you, we hope. The evidence is that it's difficult to advertise on the web, and that it's especially difficult to advertise in the personal spaces on the web, like social networking sites, texting communities. We don't think that's true. We think there are advertising opportunities, and I'm not a big proponent of advertising. I'm a big proponent of content. And the only way I think content survives if we figure this advertising thing out. I think you can advertise in social networking sites, but under a whole different set of rules. An advertiser has to become a member of the community, support its goals. Its advertising has to be relevant. An advertiser is going to be judged by standards by which it's never been judged by before. Things such as, are you a good corporate citizen? How green are you? Now, a lot of advertisers look at that and say, what the hell do I need to do all this for? I can run an ad on television, nobody's judging me, and it works or it doesn't work. The answer is the metrics, the ability of digital is to give you information as an advertiser you never could have dreamed of before. It changes the rules of nature or the rules of physics. So that on the web, you only, such as in paid search with Google, only have to spend money on people who have already demonstrated interest in your product. And that proposition is irresistible to advertisers. So when you look at Mark Zuckerberg, the creator of Facebook, he sold last year 1.6% of Facebook to Microsoft for $240 million, putting the valuation of Facebook at $15 billion. And last month, he became the youngest billionaire on the Forbes 400. But whether Mark Zuckerberg really ends up as a billionaire, or instead we see him at the side of the freeway with a paper sign saying, "We'll work for food," depends on whether Facebook can find a way to monetize itself through advertising. Because without advertising, Facebook's economic value is worthless. Its social value to its members may be great. The very last slide I want to use, and I'll end with this, my favorite thing I always do, just share with you briefly what we're finding around the world about teenagers. I spend a lot of time with teenagers. I have a lot of respect for teenagers. I love teenagers in every way that is appropriate. And as we look at teenagers, we see, as we look at them worldwide, we think they will never read an offline newspaper. But we'll read some magazines the rest of their lives. We think they'll never own a landline phone, don't even make the distinction between a landline and a mobile phone. Something we discovered by accident, we're not the only ones to discover this, teenagers aren't wearing watches. They're telling time from their mobile phones. And now the entire jewelry industry, not to mention the economy of Switzerland, is waiting to the answer to the question, will they start wearing watches when they get in their 20s and 30s? Well, we've been tracking people for 8 years. So we have people in their mid-20s who were teenagers 8 years ago. And the answer so far is still no. We think teenagers barely understand the concept of watching television on somebody else's schedule. We think in another 5 years, when you talk to a teen about the days you used to watch television, when a broadcaster told you you had to watch it, or even more extreme, that sometimes you wouldn't leave the house until the program you like had aired, or you had to be home before it started, you're going to sound to them the way our great-great-grandparents would have sounded to us, talking about arriving at a party in a horse and buggy. Something we find frightening about teens, but fortunately they seem to outgrow it, they trust unknown peers more than experts. They argue the people they meet on Facebook, Bebo, and MySpace are just like them, and they can trust them. They have no self-interest. To the degree that an unknown peer is really a peer, they may be right, but we also know that an unknown peer can be a predator or a scammer. I mentioned just a moment ago, beginning in 2005, they showed some willingness to pay for digital content. That's now giving way to advertising. Something we also find frightening, but they outgrow, is they don't care about the source of information. Their information comes aggregated on Google or Yahoo or MSN, even though the source is there. They don't pay attention. To them, all information is the same. As they get older and they make compelling decisions in their lives about careers, retirement, investments, and medical decisions and childcare, then the expertise matters. Community is at the center of everything they do. We really believe that online communities or social networking is the real deal. First thing that has caused people to log onto the web more than to check their email. While teens move transitorily through communities and go from Friendster to MySpace to Facebook and on, we think the importance of communities in their lives never diminishes. Just where they are may change. Teenagers think they're not affected by advertising or brand. I think this is charming. I don't mean that in a condescending way. They think they're too sophisticated, too smart, too shrewd to be affected by advertising. Nothing could be further from the truth. You want to see how much a teenager you know is affected by advertising or brand? Try giving him or her an MP3 player that is not an iPod and then duck as they throw it at you. Everything moves to mobile. Everybody in the world gets this except Americans. Where the rest of the world, you can land at Arlanda and go what seems to be hundreds of kilometers into the Earth's surface. It feels like you go down forever and your mobile phone still works. You can walk out of Tokyo at lunchtime and your mobile phone will show you all the restaurants in a 2-block radius that have tables available. We in America can barely get our mobile phones to work above ground for voice communication. I wish that were just a cheap joke, but it isn't, unfortunately. Those of you who have been traveling to the United States, and you really should go to the United States. We've been having a half-off sale for you over the last 2 years, although we're starting to raise prices a little bit. Thank God, for those of us who come here. But we think as India's 7% internet penetration climbs to 40%, it's not going to be with PCs on the desk. It's going to be through mobile phones. You, of course, already go on the internet in a widespread way through mobile phones. We will start to. The difference between us and you, between Americans and Swedes and Indians, as we will still, you here and we in America, will still keep PCs on our desk at work and some of us at home, but the rest of the world will go online without PCs on the desk, except those very few small percentage of people who actually need PCs, who are engineers or heavy-duty writers or things like that. Television dominates this generation less than any generation before. Doesn't mean that television's not important. It's just one of several things that's important. This is teenagers want to move their content freely from platform to platform, irrespective of anyone's desire to restrict them. The more we try to restrict them, the more they'll move it just to show us they can move it. Last summer, shortly after Apple had introduced the iPhone, and it was only legally available in the United States on AT&T, a 17-year-old kid who was on his way to college spent his entire summer unlocking the iPhone. Took him 3 months. He was the first one to do it. He was interviewed. When he was being interviewed, the case was open. Wires were hanging. And he admitted when he was being interviewed, he didn't even want an unlocked iPhone. He just wanted to stick it to Steve Jobs and show Jobs they couldn't lock the iPhone on him. A word about platforms. We think platforms are changing radically. The old model that most of us grew up with, we go on vacation, we take 100 photographs, drop them off at a corner store and have them printed, that doesn't make sense for teenagers anymore. We think teenagers will print out 15 photographs in their lifetime. 5 for their parents, and that will change when they become parents. 4 or 5 for their wallet, that will change when their smartphone becomes their wallet. And a couple for their desk or wall, and that's already becoming electronic frames. For teens today, photographs exist on the web. The web is not just the place you send them to somebody else. It's where you look at them, share them, store them, keep them. They never exist anywhere else. Concerns about climate change are going to accelerate that. CDs. We think CDs have 5 to 6 years left. We think music has a brilliant future. But CDs as a format, you can buy a 160-gigabyte iPod at a reasonable cost. Those drives are only going to get bigger and cheaper. At 160 gigabytes, you can listen to more music than you would ever listen to in your whole life. And once again, concerns about climate change are going to make CDs start to look very wasteful. DVDs at the Consumer Electronics Show this year, I was there as Sony declared victory with its Blu-ray over the high-definition DVD. That victory is almost irrelevant. We think DVDs have 6 to 8 years left. When people can store 400 or more hours of video on their televisions, their servers, their TiVos, they stop erasing, they start archiving. Very soon, we're going to move that storage from the local unit to a network outside the home. Once again, climate change is going to make DVDs with their packaging and their physical goods seem wasteful. Ironically, the format that will survive the longest, I don't know if it will survive forever, is our oldest format, books. Even though we have a Sony reader and an Amazon Kindle, we think books will survive for the long term. There's still people still enjoy the pleasure of buying a book and then having it forever. That can be a curse if you have too many books, as I do. People also like taking books when they're finished with them and they actually furnish their homes by putting them on the shelf. And sometimes they put books on the shelves they've never read so the people think they have read them. But we think books will survive for a very long time. Next to last, this is a generation that wants to be heard. Why there's so many blogs, social networks. To paraphrase Andy Warhol, this is a generation that couldn't care less about 15 minutes of fame. What they care about is 15 megabytes of fame. And lastly, to those of us who are online and think we're hip and cool because we send email, to today's teenagers, email's something their parents do. Old people send email. They IM or they communicate through social networks. Now, they like synchronous communication because they can be in front of a screen a large percentage of the time. As they get older and pesky things get in their way, like jobs, spouses, and children, the asynchronicity of email becomes very appealing. The fact that you look at it when you're ready and answer it even later. That's a little bit of the work I do. Anyone who's interested in going, first of all, you should take a good look at the wonderful Swedish report that is in your bag, or if not, there are copies outside. Anyone who's interested in our work is welcome to go to our website and also get directions to all the other countries we work with as well. And also this, I think other than a short addenda, this is the end, so I'm happy to hang around after you finalize this and answer questions or talk to people. It's late. You've been wonderful. I appreciate your attention. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much. And I would like to give you a small lift.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Since I can't take this on the plane, I mean,
You have to consume it this evening then. All right. I hope that you excuse me for switching to Swedish. Okej. Okay. Nu kanske ni undrar varför ni fick små miniräknare när ni kom in. Jag vet inte om alla har kvitterat ut en sån här liten dosa. Det är så här nämligen att jag kommer ifrån dataföreningen. Inger Gran heter jag. Och vi startade en tankesmedja som heter Forum Internet strax före årsskiftet. Och nu ska jag se till att jag kan starta igång det här. Så ska ni få vara med och bidra lite till någonting som vi kallar för aktionsforskning. Så vi ser, nu är det lite sent på kvällen så vi får väl se hur det här funkar. De här små, det finns väl några av er kanske som fanns, som har lyssnat på 10 topp någon gång. Jag har i alla fall gjort det. Då fanns det mentometer. Jag vet inte hur de såg ut, för jag var aldrig på någon sån här 10 topp aktivitet. Men det lät ungefär som något maskingevär eller något sånt. Men det var mentometerknappar i alla fall. Och så röstade man fram då de olika låtarna. Och det ni har i handen är faktiskt mentometerknappar. Nu ska vi se. Här har vi den där. Nej, hade vi inte alls. Tog jag upp fel? Spänningen är olidlig, visst är det? Där har vi den. Nu ni. Nu blir det spännande. Ja, här står det som jag sa alldeles för en liten stund sen. Och tror ni att det funkar då? Nej. Jo, det gjorde det. Det här är då tre utav oss som bildar den här tankesmedjan. Det är jag då och så är det två stycken killar som ni ser och de sitter faktiskt i publiken här ute. Vi har en fjärde person också som finns med som heter Olle Findahl som också finns med i World Internet Institute. Kopplingen till Jeff Cole. Det här är doserna. Har alla doser? Ja, de flesta har i alla fall. Bra. Nu ska vi se om de här fungerar. Då gör ni så här. Att ni tar fram era doser. Då ska vi se om ni har något koll på det här med stiftelsen Internetinfrastruktur. Alltså I-stiftelsen. Eller .se eller vad vi nu... Kärt barn har många namn, vet ni. Då väljer ni det alternativ som ni tror är rätt. Och så trycker ni nu. Nu ska det bli väldigt spännande att se. Jag tror inte att det här funkar, förstår ni? Nu ska jag se om jag kan ta och stänga av det här och börja från början. Det borde funka. Mycket märkligt. Det var ju himla dumt. Får börja från början. Det gjorde det. Börja lysa hos dig. Vi provar en gång till då får vi se. Tryck. Hade ni rätt svar förresten? Hur som helst så är det så här att vi vill alltså ta reda på vad ni egentligen tycker om de här olika områdena. Och då har vi naturligtvis ett forskningsunderlag som vi utgår ifrån. Och det har ju pågår ju en hel del forskning om just de här olika delarna. Och Håkan Selje som är en av oss i Tankesmedjan, han har bland annat varit engagerad i någonting som heter Internet Explorers. Han har varit engagerad i någonting som heter Namnam. Och också Sunnetundersökningen. Och de här undersökningarna, de har vänt sig till anställda och studenter på 32 högskolor och universitet här runt om i Sverige. De svaren som vi har fått fram, eller som Håkan då tillsammans med bland annat Olle Findahl har fått fram, de utgör underlaget som vi sen bygger på med ytterligare frågor och svar ifrån. Som ni till exempel, så får vi ännu mer information om vad som gör att internet överhuvudtaget utvecklas. Att tjänsterna på internet utvecklas och hur vi använder internet. Och de här fyra områdena presenterar vi och genomför det som vi kallar aktionsforskning. Nu ska vi se. Och bland annat så en fråga är ju om man brukar besöka nätgemenskaper. Det är vårat namn för communities. Så det jag vill att ni gör nu, det är att ni tar fram era mentometerknappar. Och så trycker ni då på ja om ni besöker communities och nej om ni inte gör det. Nu lagras då den här informationen som vi får fram i en databas här. Och det kan vi sen då jämföra med den informationen som vi redan har. Då är frågan, vilka av följande nätgemenskaper brukar ni då besöka? Om ni nu besöker några. Men då ser ni att alternativet 7 är ju ingen. Men ni kan ju också besöka flera stycken av de här. Det innebär alltså att ni kan trycka på flera olika alternativ. Då tryck, om det är så att ni skulle besöka alla 6, då trycker ni 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okej? Då kör vi. Tror du jag? Nu? Nej. Tekniken vill inte vara med mig idag. Det blir väldigt intressant att se. Ni tryckte i alla fall, fast ni tryckte på en annan fråga. De här nätgemenskaperna, ni kanske hann åtminstone se vad det var för typer av nätgemenskaper. Det är de som är vanligast förekommande när vi har sett på de undersökningarna som hittills har gjorts. Alltså när det är utifrån ett svenskt perspektiv. Det vi också kan titta på vad som händer med medlemmarna i nätgemenskaperna är att man tar del av innehåll som andra laddat upp. Man ger kommentarer, man tar kontakter, man laddar upp eget innehåll, man köper tilläggstjänster av olika slag och man tipsar kompisar. Då går vi vidare. Så här såg resultatet ut på den undersökningen som är så att säga det som vi utgår ifrån, baskunskaperna som vi redan har. Det visar sig alltså att av 100% som använder internet så är 64% besöker nätgemenskaper. 59% är medlem i någon eller några nätgemenskaper. 51% bidrar ibland. 13% bidrar ofta. Och 8% driver egen nätgemenskap. Sen övergår vi till det här med bloggar. Brukar du läsa bloggar? Svara nu. Ja, ibland. Men det var rätt många som inte gör det. Går vi till nästa fråga. Brukar du skriva kommentarer och inlägg på andras bloggar? Ja, ofta. Ja, ibland. Eller inte alls. Då trycker vi nu. Det som är rätt spännande i den här grundläggande undersökningen som vi så att säga utgår ifrån, det är att det finns en väldigt diskrepans i ålder. Men det återkommer jag till. Jag undrar vad det är för ålder på er som sitter här inne. Nästa fråga är om du driver egen blogg. Då trycker vi nu. Jag har förstått att de som gör det, driver egen blogg, de har fullt sjå. Att det tar mycket tid att skriva egen blogg. Ja, ni var inte så intresserade av det, ser jag. Då fortsätter vi. Så här ser det ut på bloggare vid svenska högskolor. Det är 50% ungefär som läser bloggar. 22% skriver inlägg och 10% har egen blogg. Då är det ju också så här, man kan ju fundera på det jag sa tidigare, det här med åldersstrukturen. De studenterna på högskolorna har ju en något lägre ålder än vad vi har här, kan jag se. Så det kan ju faktiskt vara en av anledningarna. Det har nämligen visat sig så att det finns en tydlig gräns vid 35 år. Så det kanske beror på det. Alla sådana här undersökningar har ju vissa bakgrundsfrågor. Så att när man gör korstabuleringar så att man också använder de här bakgrundsfrågorna. Så nu ska ni få svara på det. Det här är inte så svårt, va? Då trycker vi. Det som det brukar vara i sådana här sammanhang. Okej. Då är frågan när du är född. Nu ska vi se vad vi har för medelålder här. Om det blir någonstans på mellan 2 och 3 kanske. Vi får väl se. Då trycker ni. Ja, det var inte så dåligt gissat. Och då kan man ju undra, men varför hela fridens dag kommer den här frågan upp då? Det här med fildelningstjänster. Jo, det visar sig så här att när vi tittar på de som är aktiva på nätet så finns det ett mycket tydligt samband mellan de som är aktiva på nätet och de som är eller har varit fildelare. Så att det finns en koppling till det. Och när jag säger fildelare så betyder ju inte det att det är olaglig fildelning. Utan fildelare. Och då kanske det finns vän av ordning som undrar, finns det laglig fildelning? Och det vet ni ju att det gör det ju. Okej, då trycker ni nu. då är ni aktiva på nätet med andra ord. Om det är så att allting stämmer. Det vi kan se det är att skillnaden mellan män och kvinnor minskar. Och det har vi hört tidigare idag också. Kvinnor, mer och mer, det är kvinnor som bloggar. Kvinnor är mer aktiva på nätet överhuvudtaget. Att använda genererat innehåll är en generationsfråga. Att gränsen går vid 35 år. Så när Jeff pratade om ungdomarna och hur ungdomarna beter sig, de som är liksom födda på nätet eller med nätet som en naturlig del i vardagen, de beter sig ju naturligtvis på ett annat sätt än vi som har kommit med så här på senare tid. Och att fildelningen återspeglar interaktivitet, så är man en aktiv fildelare så är man också, eller har varit, så är man också aktiv på internet. Och då är det så här att det finns en sajt och som heter så här. Vi ser om det funkar. Och där finns det webbfrågor. Så jag skulle verkligen uppskatta om, i och med att det krånglade så tekniken här i början, att ni går in på nätet på den här länken och svara på webbfrågorna som finns där, så bidrar ni till att vi får veta ännu mer och att vår aktionsforskning blir riktigt lyckosam. Nähepp. Det funkade inte. Ja, det är stängt. Okej, så den här URL:en foruminternet.se. Gå in där, svara på de här webbfrågorna, är ni snälla. Och nu står Lennart där uppe och gör så här på klockan hela tiden. För det är visst mat som väntar, eller hur var det? Det är mat och mingel som väntar. Så tack så mycket för era tålamod. Tack ska ni ha. Hej.